You're listening to Gloria Minot Presents.
My guest is Christian Piccolini. His book, White American Youth, with white nationalist rallies from Charlottesville to Berkeley, Boston to Shelbyville, Tennessee, drawing the ire of the nation and the world, Christian Piccolini has emerged as the foremost expert who can unpack the dangerous psychology of the ever-growing white supremacist movement. Let's talk about you for a moment. A skinhead leader at age 16, how old were you when you started in the movement?
I was 14 years old in 1987 when I was recruited into America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group.
Who recruited you and how?
I was recruited by an individual by the name of Clark Martel, who was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader, who had started the organization in 1984. And I grew up a very marginalized, very lonely and bullied young person and didn't quite fit in into any social groups, though I tried very hard. And one day at 14 years old, when I was standing in an alley smoking a joint, this man came up to me and he pulled the joint from my lips and looked me in the eyes and said, "That's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile." And that was the day I was recruited into the movement, even though I had no idea what a communist was, what a Jew was, or what even the word docile meant. And it was as if this man had given me the first lifeline into acceptance. And I was looking and searching very profoundly for an identity and a community and a purpose. And it seemed as though this man, even though I had no idea what I was talking about, was promising me all those things.
Tell us about your parents.
My parents are Italian immigrants who came to the United States in the mid-1960s, and because they were immigrants, had to work extremely hard to support their family. So my parents would be gone from the home about 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, and because of that, I felt very abandoned by my parents, though I recognize now that, you know, they certainly were just working hard to support their family. At a young age, I didn't quite understand that. I often wondered what I had done to push them away. And I went searching for another family to replace that.
I read where a friend of yours said, "Skinheads are not bad people, but they are people who, at a vulnerable time in their lives, were swayed by bad ideas." And I'm looking at that and reading that and thinking, I wonder what Heather Heyer, the woman who was killed in Charlottesville, what her family would say about them.
Well, I've actually had the privilege to meet with Susan Breaux, Heather's mother, fairly recently. And I don't know where that quote necessarily came from, but, you know, I would say that young people are brought into the skinhead movement without really understanding what it is that they're being brought into, because it doesn't start out as a call or a recruitment tactic to offer racism. In fact, it plays on the vulnerabilities of young people, whatever it is that they're missing in their lives. Recruiters fill with promises of paradise. And it's about instilling a sense of pride in people who maybe didn't have any. And then that, of course, ramps up from a sense of pride into one of feeling that pride is being taken away from you. And then certainly it's blamed on certain groups of people who are taking that away from you. So young people, I don't know that the statement that skinheads are good people, but they're led in bad directions, is I believe that they're turned into skinheads with the intention of leading them into a bad direction. But I think that young people who become skinheads don't quite understand what the world that they're about to essentially engulf themselves in and detach themselves from the rest of the world.
I was looking at an interview last night, and you were I don't remember the name of the woman, and she was talking about this friend of yours who have also left the movement, and she was looking back and saying, you know, at the time when we were involved, you know, we didn't think of ourselves as bad people. We just thought that, you know, what I said. So that's where I got that from.
Yeah, you know, I think that while we were in the movement, we were conditioned to believe that what we were doing was right and that everybody else was wrong. So certainly while I was involved, I did have the sense that I was, you know, making the world a better place for my own agenda. And that's often something, you know, that comes along with the territory of being indoctrinated, then believing what it is that you're fed. And certainly there's always the fear of if you question what you're involved in, there's a security issue, but also it's a fear of starting over, of abandoning this community now that you have that accepts you, when many times that's the only community that's ever accepted you. So yes, we did, you know, we did have this feeling that what we were doing was the right thing, but there were also, you know, many instances of confusion and questioning that we weren't brave enough to really follow through with because we were in fear of abandoning ourselves from this lifestyle.
My guest is Christian Piccolini. We're talking about his book, White American Youth, A Stunning Look Inside the World of the Violent White Nationalism. Of course, he was involved in that. He's no longer involved in that, and we're going to be talking about this. But let's talk a moment about the conscious effort being made by the alt-right, and we'll talk about how that term came about, to market itself differently. Guys started wearing Brooks Brothers suits, started, you know, looking like they were headed for Wall Street in order to convince other young people to join the movement. Talk about that decision and why it was made.
Well, 30 years ago, when I was involved in the movement, we recognized that our look, our shaved heads and tattoos and the swastika flags were turning away the average American white racist that we would prefer to recruit. So we decided to alter our image and traded in our boots for suits. We started to grow our hair out. We began to recruit on college campuses where we recognized that there were young people forming opinions, breaking away from their family structure and joining new communities, and that they were vulnerable. We decided to get jobs in law enforcement and get training in the military and even run for office. And I would say that David Duke in the 80s was probably one of the first people to embrace this and throw off the Klan robe and put on a suit and run for office. And here we are 30 years later, and the older we pushed down the hill has gathered steam, and certainly the movement that we see now is a cancer that's metastasized into something that looks completely different, is marketed differently and more appealingly, but underlying it is the same hateful ideology that I was a part of 30 years ago. So what we see today with the khakis and the polos and the suits and this fashionable subculture that's emerged is really just a tactic to blend in, to normalize, to look like our doctors, our lawyers, our dentists, our teachers, our homemakers, and more effectively spread the message by making it just slightly more palatable and using words that that aren't red flags for anybody, but instead replaced with words that we're now calling dog whistles.
What changed your path of hate? What made you reject hate finally?
Well, I started out and, you know, I wasn't raised in a culture of racism. It wasn't part of my family DNA. In fact, my parents were often the victims of prejudice because of being immigrants themselves. And, you know, I always had questions during those 8 years that I was involved from the time I was 14 until I was 22 and eventually became a leader. And, but I suppressed those feelings of what I called moments of clarity that didn't necessarily mesh with the ideology I had adopted. But I suppressed those because what I was receiving from the movement was more important to me at the time. I was accepted. I felt respected. I felt this perception of power, whereas before I'd felt very powerless. But ultimately what helped me disengage was the repeated interactions with people that I thought I hated. In fact, it was the people I hated that showed me compassion when I least deserved it, and frankly, they were the people I least deserved it from. And over time, I began to humanize these people rather than demonize them. I had this prejudice in my head of who they were and this demonization. But once I had a meaningful interaction with them and repeatedly had those interactions, I began to understand that It didn't fit this narrative that was in my head. And I started to feel more similarity with the people that I thought I hated than the ones I'd surrounded myself with.
And let's talk about two specific instances. There was a time when a group of you were beating up a young black man, and there was a time when you got a job at IBM and went back to your old high school. Talk to us about those two instances.
Sure. Well, the first instance was when I was involved in the movement in 91 or 92, I believe. And some of my colleagues in the movement and I were out drinking one night and walked into a McDonald's restaurant where there were a few black teenagers standing in line. And we chased them out of the McDonald's. And as they ran across the street, one of the black teenagers pulled out a firearm and began to shoot at us, and the gun jammed. And when we caught this individual, we beat him very badly. And as I was kicking him on the ground, his face covered in blood and his face swollen, he opened his eyes and looked at me and connected. And I felt an instant empathy towards this young man that I'd never met before, that I was very intent on hurting. And I thought for a moment that it could be my brother, or it could be a family member, or somebody that I really cared about, and that the implications of this would not just affect this young man, but, you know, his community. And I couldn't help but think that, you know, this could have happened to somebody that I loved because of what I was involved in. The IBM job was an interesting one. You know, 5 years after I left the movement, after going through a very dark depression, I was running away from my past. I tried to move and make new friends, and I certainly was treating other people with respect, but I wasn't treating myself with very much respect. At the end of that 5 years, a friend came to me, and she urged me to go apply for a job at IBM where she was working, and I thought she was crazy, of course, because here I was, this guy with, you know, Nazi tattoos and had been kicked out of six high schools, one of them twice, and didn't go to university. But I decided to go on the interview, eventually I got the job, and I was thrilled that I was going to learn a new trade and that my life was going to become better, until I recognized that the first job that they would be putting me in was at my old high school, the same one I was kicked out of twice. And I was terrified. I thought for sure that somebody was going to point me out and that I would lose this job that had so much promise. And of course, as karma or destiny would have it, within the first few hours, a man that I recognized walked past my path. He didn't recognize me, but I decided to follow him to the parking lot. And when I tapped this man on his shoulder, he was an African-American man who had been the security guard while I was in high school there. When I tapped him on the shoulder, he took a look at me and he stepped back in fear, because this was a man I had been physically violent with, who I had been verbally abusive towards. And eventually I found the words to say that I was sorry. And we spoke and embraced, and he made me promise that I would tell my story to the world. And in fact, that was the genesis of me starting to write my book back in 2000. And I really owe this gentleman my life, and we've since become very, very good friends, and I respect him very much, and I'm so grateful for him recognizing that this wasn't just the story of some young kid from a broken home who ended up joining a violent gang. This was really the story of every young person who was desperately searching for identity, community, and purpose, but felt marginalized, so much so that I was detoured down a dark alley to find that type of acceptance.
Finally, how do current hate group members respond to your new path?
Well, certainly they are threatened by it because I understand the language. I understand the way that things have changed over the last 30 years. I'm very in tune to why young people gravitate towards these groups, but I also understand what it takes to help people disengage. And in fact, I've helped over 100 people disengage over the last 18 years from the same movement that I helped build. So I think that they see me, as a threat. They certainly vocalize it as me being a race traitor. I think that they wouldn't give me this much attention and I wouldn't receive this many threats if what I was doing wasn't something that is disruptive to what they're trying to do.
His book is White American Youth. He's Christian Piccolini. Thank you so much for sharing your story. All the best.
Gloria, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
For more information about Gloria Minot Presents, go to GloriaMinotPresents, one word, .com.